I think everyone here has faced the grim truth. Men are waging a war against women, except it's more like a slaughter. We need a resistance movement. And that's hard enough, but over the last 30 years, a great many of our potential recruits have turned tail and joined the enemy. As early as 1982, Ellen Willis invented the term sex positive to distinguish herself from radical feminists. Because we're so negative, us radicals. Rape, 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 it's all we want to talk about. I'll make you a deal. If men stop with the rape, I'll stop talking about it. Next slide. So it's been 30 years. To this day, I cannot fathom what is positive about abuse, slavery, or torture with a dose of capitalism added for good measure. So I Googled here, torture porn is my search term. There are 32 million hits for this. I had to update the slide this week. First time I used it was 3 years ago. We were at 20 million. Now they're at 32 million. So their hunger for this is bottomless. Not yet. I'm now going to show you the images. If you hit images, what you will see, you do not have to look. I'm just warning you, if you need to shut your eyes, if you don't got the strength on this morning, I understand it. Look down. You're only going to see it for a second, and then we'll move from it. But I'm just warning you before we hit it. So hit the slide. Done to anyone besides women, these would be recognized as human rights abuses. Done to women, they're good, clean, sexy, positive fun. Okay. That's it. There's no more bad ones. In 1991, Rebecca Walker coined the term third wave to describe this positive approach to women's oppression. Next slide. It's kind of like feminism, only without that pesky feminism. So it's a celebration of sexuality as a positive aspect of life. If anyone's confused about what we're celebrating, I can back up two slides. Pornography and so-called sex work are now empowering. Don't let them slip this one by you. Our goal was never empowerment. It's liberation. Some third-wave feminists prefer not to call themselves feminists. There is at least one point of agreement, because I actually prefer that they not call themselves feminist either. So here we are, insensitive to fluid notions of gender. There's no actual feminism in this. To say that gender is fluid is a complete erasure of the fact of women's oppression. I will offer yet again to back up two slides if there's any confusion. There is nothing fluid about the material conditions, up to and including torture, that create the class of people called women. And finally, the focus is less on political changes and more on individualistic identity. Now, it's interesting to me that they come out and say this so directly. Of course, they say it like it's a good thing, rather than the profound defeat that it is. A movement once big enough and bold enough to call for everything from abortion on demand to a lesbian nation has been reduced to obsessing over what each woman should call herself while the war rages on. Now, all of this actually cuts to the main divisions between liberals and radicals more broadly. So you've heard of speed dating? Well, I call this speed revolution. liberals believe that society is made up of individuals, and individualism is so sacrosanct that, in this view, being identified as a member of a group or a class of any kind, that's considered an insult. For radicals, society is made up of classes, and these were economic classes in Marx's original version, but really any group or caste. So society is made up of groups of people, and some of those groups have power over other groups. So in the radical's understanding, being a member of a group is not the affront. It's far from it. Identifying with the group is the first step toward political consciousness and ultimately effective political action. You make common cause with the people who share your condition. The other big division between liberals and radicals is on the nature of social reality itself. And liberalism is called idealist. So social reality is made up of attitudes, of ideas, and social change happens through rational argument and education. Materialism, over on the radical side, means that society is organized by concrete systems of power. It's material reality, not by thoughts and ideas, okay? Material institutions. And the solution to oppression is ultimately to take those systems apart brick by brick. So the liberals will say, well, we have to educate, educate, educate. And the radicals say, well, no, we actually have to stop them. And if you remove power from the equation, oppression looks either natural or voluntary, because it erases the fact that it's social subordination. So things like race and gender are politically quite real. All right, they're brutally, viciously real. But it's the ideology of the powerful that always makes claims for some immutable origin, you know, like biology. And this is a famous article from history. There are piles of others, though, and they're all desperate to prove that black people are naturally inferior. Next slide. There's charts, there's pictures. Next slide. This is the propaganda of power. And in this article, Robert Bennett Bean also made the argument that the same brain differences exist in, guess who? Yeah. Women and poor people. So it's all there. Black people, poor people, and women have stupid for brains. So when you naturalize political categories, it makes them impossible to question. There's no point in challenging nature or evolution or God. But ultimately, these are unjust systems of power, and they are going to have to be dismantled. So naturalism operates in the service of power. Well, so does voluntarism. Because if you're not going to go the biological route to explain away injustice, the only route you have left is the voluntary route. Okay, next. What liberals don't understand is that 90% of oppression is consensual. As Florence Kennedy wrote, there can be no really pervasive system of oppression without the consent of the oppressed. This does not mean that it's our fault, that the system will crumble if we withdraw consent, or that the oppressed are responsible for their oppression. All it means is that the powerful, like capitalists, white supremacists, misogynists, they can't stand over vast numbers of people with guns 24 hours a day. Now, luckily for them, depressingly for the rest of us, they don't have to. People withstand oppression using three psychological methods: denial, accommodation, and consent. Anyone on the receiving end of domination learns early in life to stay in line or risk the consequences, and those consequences only have to be applied once in a while to be effective. The traumatized psyche will then police itself. So, if they had but known they were slaves. Next. There are entire bodies of discourse that ask the question of how the powerful get the oppressed to internalize the values of the oppressor. It's why the word hegemony was invented. But the take-home point, do not ever conflate consent with liberation. Consent is accommodation to unjust conditions that we do not control. Liberation is the complete overthrow of those conditions. Final difference between liberals and radicals is in approaches to justice. Since power is invisible in the liberal schema, justice is served by abstract principles. For the radicals, justice cannot be blind. Concrete conditions must be recognized and addressed for anything to change. Domination will only be dismantled by taking away the rights of the powerful and redistributing social power to the rest of us. So I've been using the word oppression. I haven't really defined it. Luckily, we have Marilyn Frye. Oppression is a system of interrelated forces and barriers which reduce, immobilize, and mold people who belong to a certain group and affect their subordination to another group. Now, this is radicalism in one elegant sentence. Oppression is not an attitude, it's about systems of power. And one of the harms of subordination is that it creates not only injustice, exploitation, and abuse, but also consent. She uses the image of a birdcage. One wire will not hold that bird, but oppression is like a cage. It's a system of interrelated barriers and forces. It's all those wires working together. So, one large set of wires for women, sex across the political spectrum. So on the right, sex is an impulse that has to be contained and controlled, and it's generally seen as something that's basically bad because it has to be controlled. On the left, sex is good, and it's an impulse that needs to be liberated. For feminists, it's not either of these things. Sex is what human societies make of it. So it can be good, like pleasure, like connection, or it can be bad, like rape or prostitution or abuse. On the right, sex is seen as natural, but that means intercourse and heterosexual marriage for procreation. So some sex is unnatural or bad. Okay. On the left, all sex is natural and beyond examination. So the right says some is good, some is bad. Left says all is good. Feminist says it's neither. Sex is political, and sexual practices are created by humans, i.e. they can be questioned. So it's not natural. See, these people are saying it's natural. We're saying it's not. On the right, sex is naturally hierarchical, and it involves punishing women and breaking boundaries. On the left, what do you know? Sex is naturally hierarchical. It involves punishing women and breaking boundaries. Feminists, this culture defines sex as eroticized domination, subordination. So it's true that's how we experience it, okay? And that starts with masculine and feminine. But that's a cultural definition. That's not natural. They're saying it's naturally hierarchical. We're saying that's not natural. This is political. This is an institution that we can question. Over on the right, women need to accept and enjoy their place in that hierarchy. And what do you know on the left? Women need to accept and enjoy their place in the hierarchy.
Feminists say women need to fight back, that these sexual practices that eroticize domination need to be abandoned. And finally, on the right, so that the thing that women have to accept is that it's private. So one man owns one woman in marriage, and that's for family and procreation. The left says that place is public. All men need access to all women. So that's the difference between the right and the left. And we say that boundaries are absolute and would need to be respected within a culture that cherishes and protects physical integrity. Now, because feminism came out of the left, we made tremendous efforts not to name sex, because sex was automatically good on the left side. Also because we were rightfully afraid of the insults that men use when we question or reject their system. Everything from "you're a prude" to the classic "you just need a..." Gosh, we all know how that sentence ends. You know, it's been 6,000 years. You'd think they could come up with something different. Ultimately, when we question sex, what we were questioning is male entitlement to women's bodies, because sex is the form that that entitlement primarily takes. The real brilliance of patriarchy is right here. It doesn't just naturalize oppression. All oppressive systems do that. They naturalize. It doesn't just naturalize, though. It sexualizes acts of oppression. So it eroticizes domination and submission, and that it institutionalizes those into masculine and feminine. Okay, so it naturalizes, then it eroticizes, and finally it institutionalizes domination and submission. The brilliance of feminism is that we figured that out. So we get accused of being in bed with the right. Okay, we're never in the living room. We're never in the kitchen. It's never in the library. It's always in bed. But I got to say, with this chart, the right and the left are what are looking awfully cozy here. Okay, next slide. And finally, the differences between third-wave feminism and actual feminism. So the third-wave position is that power is inevitable. It's basic to the universe, to nature, to all human relationships. And the radical feminists say, no, power is political. Again, it's created by human societies. They say that power is always erotic. We say power is eroticized under male supremacy. Yes, we may have these reactions and experiences, but feminist resistance is possible. And that includes the reclamation of our sexuality from patterns of domination and submission. An example of this, okay, next slide. So, Susie Bright, I mean, this is just one example among many. If you don't know who she is, she's got this vast platform across pop culture. She writes for The Village Voice. She's written for Hustler, for Penthouse. She started her own porn magazine. In this book, which of course was wildly popular, next slide, she has her cornerstones of eroticism. So to her, this is what's erotic. The first one, actually, longing and anticipation, that actually seems accurate. So Susie and I do agree on one thing. So next slide. We can take that one off the list. But the next three, we have violating prohibitions, searching for power, and overcoming ambivalence. Wildly popular book. Violating prohibitions. Nobody is violating anything in my bedroom. Number two, searching for power. This is what has replaced the search for connection, communication, or God forbid, love. Are we allowed to say love? Or has the culture been so destroyed by cynicism and sadism? I know there's no ironic distance or slick image in love. Love is, in fact, the opposite. So never mind the love that dare not speak its name. Love itself is now unspeakable. And then there's overcoming ambivalence. I would guess that most of us in this room have had our ambivalence overcome, and it was not, in fact, a positive experience. She's saying that rape is the model for the erotic. Okay, so back to this. So they say that the culture at large is repressive towards sexuality. Next slide. And I want to ask them, on what planet? We are saturated with these images of women objectified, dismembered, and sold as sex. Just saturated at this point. Okay, next slide. So for the third wave, feminism is about agency. And here's a direct quote. Next slide. Feminism is, this is their definition, whether you decide as a woman to make your own aesthetic choices and decisions. Okay, that is called accommodation. It is what oppressed people do all the time because it's mostly the only option we've got. It is not the goal of feminism. The point of a serious liberation movement is to change the material conditions under which we are forced to live. You'll notice it's aesthetic decisions as well. It's not political decisions. It's not ethical decisions. It's not even spiritual decisions. No, it's always, do I look pretty in pink? This is what women are allowed to decide about, and now we call it feminism. Okay, next. Andrea Dworkin's diagram of those material conditions. She called it the barricade of sexual terrorism.
We need to change those conditions, not make the best decisions we can under those conditions, not get attention from the people in power under those conditions, not make the best deal we can with the people in power under those conditions, but change the material conditions. So our task remains to tear down that wall of sexual violence that barricades us all. Meanwhile, meet Joelle Ruby Ryan, professor of, wait for it, women's studies. One might reasonably wonder why Ryan got a job teaching women's studies, if female is such an offensive word. But the bigger fault line here is between feminism and postmodernism, and its offspring of queer theory and third wave feminism. To make sex class a dirty word means that the realities of women's lives are now unspeakable, and each woman is cut adrift in a hostile, chaotic sea. Apply the word sex class, and that chaos snaps into a sharp pattern of subordination, from the small daily insults to body and soul to the shattering traumas of incest and rape. The crimes men commit against women aren't done to women as random individuals. They're done because women belong to a subordinate class, and they're done to keep women a subordinate class. But the solution to oppression is always embedded in the problem. You make common cause with the people who share your condition. Sisterhood is indeed powerful. The women who built the most recent sisterhood, the second wave, are being derided by genderists like Ryan. The insults usually reference bad haircuts and fashion, because how women look is vastly more important than what we might try to do. A short catalog of women's silly little projects, rape crisis hotlines, battered women's shelters, abortion and birth control on demand, sex-neutral help wanted ads, sexual harassment laws, equal funding for girls' sports, and a storming of the barricades across the trades and professions. My mother endured the torture of an illegal abortion in 1961. These are life and death issues for women, and only someone very short on memory or very long on male privilege could call them passé. So ultimately, this kind of third-wave postmodernism, they say there's no such thing as reality. And this is basically the core of this postmodern framework. The two men foundational to this are Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault. The thing to know about these men, they were both members of pro-pedophile organizations that argued not just for the lowering of the age of consent laws, the eradication of age of consent laws. Foucault believed there was such a thing as, quote, non-abusive pedophilia. So, complete sexual access to children. It is not a mistake or a misdirection that postmodernism has led us right here. So we say that universal human rights are called universal for a reason. The third wave solution is that it's subversive, transgressive, or radical to dress up like Nazis or play master and slave. So here's someone else who's been trashing radical feminism for 30 years, Amber Hallenbaugh. It's interesting that on occasion they see the problem. If the forbidden is connected to taboo, how can we resist oppression without destroying our means to excitement? I don't know, Amber. That would be your problem, not mine. Okay. We want a world where domination and torture are unthinkable, and it may give some women some kind of sexual thrill, but breaking boundaries is not a program with a future, not for the women and children made ever more vulnerable by poverty, racism, and increasingly rising tide of sexual fascism. Now, I was born in 1964. I remember the world before pornography took over. Yeah, it was there, but it wasn't everywhere. And in my lifetime, I have watched as men have created new forms of rape and then normalized those into just sex. To the women who are younger than I am sorry. If it's any consolation, some of us saw it coming and we tried. But it was like trying to stop a tsunami. I'm not giving up, but I don't have a lot of hope. What do we have on our side? Well, I think we have righteousness, and I think we have truth. Righteousness because human rights abuses, no matter how sexy those abuses feel for the perpetrator, are wrong. And truth because women count as human, and from this I will not budge. The pornographers give away their game every time. The first sentence of this book, the very first sentence, liars. This matches nothing in me. When I think of lust, of desire, it's born of the aching honesty of intimacy, of reaching toward another human being in the hope that someone is reaching back. Dishonesty destroys that fragile faith called trust. And when we betray our beloved in her vulnerability, something in us is diminished as well. The difference between the sexuality of pornography and ultimately patriarchy is summed up really succinctly in this book, and this is a very good book. They've got this great chart. They broke it down. Porn sex is harmful, hurtful, it's dominating, and it is deceitful. It's done to someone. It's not shared with someone, and it is shameful. We should be ashamed if we do these things to another human being. Real desire reveals, it trusts, and it heals. It's communication that longs to reach communion. It's the best of us. I refuse to believe that the sex of cruel, selfish usury is sex to be celebrated. I refuse to believe that exploitation is the truth of sex, and I refuse to live in a universe where that is the only option. And I will never betray my beloved, so no, I am not giving up. But we have to face what we are up against. We live in a culture that is organized around sadism. Boys become men by learning to dominate, by learning to take, by learning ownership and entitlement and control. Men become real men by breaking boundaries. And masculinity is based on a violation imperative. That violation imperative includes violating the boundaries of women and children, violating the boundaries of rivers and forests. It includes violating the DNA of other species, and it includes violating the integrity of the atom itself. So that eroticization of power, that barricade of sexual terrorism, brick by brick, we have to bring it down, not accommodate to it, not make the best decisions we can inside it, but bring it down. We're going to have to match their contempt with our courage. We are going to have to match their brute power with our fierce and fragile dreams. And we're going to have to match that endless sadism with a determination that will not bend and will not break and will not stop. And if we can't do it for ourselves, we've got to do it for her. Now, you love something or you wouldn't be here today. Whatever you love, it is under assault. But love is a verb, and may that love call us to action. Thank you.
So I'm going to speak for a little bit, and then I think we're going to have some time for questions because we go till 11:30. So my name is Samantha Gray, and I am a rape crisis worker at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. I'm also Assiniboine from the Carry the Kettle First Nation. Rape Relief is Canada's oldest rape crisis center, and we receive 1,200 new calls from women experiencing male violence every year. Pornography is vastly accessible and accepted as a normal expression of human sexuality and is a visible faucet in our society. We saw some with Lierre in her slides. I have a few examples. So this year, the Adult Video Awards just had their 33rd annual ceremony, celebrating films like The Submission of Emma Marks and Bang Bus. Pornhub, one of the largest porn sites, reported 21.2 billion site visits in 2015, with Canadians being the third most frequent visitors. From our crisis work, we can see that pornography has a significant influence on men's sexist violence against women. And it's not just limited to one form of male violence, but all forms of male violence, such as sexual harassment, rape, wife assault, incest, and prostitution. When women called us about incest, they told us about being shown pornography at a young age by their male family members on purpose. One woman told us about coming out as a lesbian to her family, only to have her stepfather show her heterosexual pornography and then molest her as an attempt to make her straight. Other women have called our crisis lines about men forcing them to reenact scenes in pornography as children, which is a common tendency amongst men who rape women of all ages. This tendency to force women to enact what men see in pornography counters any assertion that pornography is just fantasy. We see this most often with women in relationships. Their husbands or boyfriends will view violent pornography and then force their girlfriends or wives to recreate what they saw. Oftentimes, women are forced to endure violent acts such as choke play, rape fantasies, BDSM, which are all fallacies because they are actual violence inflicted onto women. Men use their position in intimate relationships to not only pressure women into performing these acts, but also to record them. As we see on the crisis lines, men will then use these recordings to punish women if they resist or attempt to leave. Additionally, men will often excuse their viewing habits when their girlfriends refuse to have sex with them. Male lovers tell their girlfriends they are crazy and unreasonable when women disapprove of pornography. One woman told us about her boyfriend forcing her to watch porn to get her in the mood. Women are told by both violent men and society as a whole that viewing pornography is part of a healthy, normal sexuality. Outside of their homes and intimate relationships, women are subjected to pornography in the workplace. Women told us of male bosses and co-workers who purposely watched pornography in the workplace to make them feel uncomfortable and to establish the male hierarchy within the workplace. Recently, many female RCMP officers came forward about sexual harassment from their male colleagues who, as a part of their harassment, would put pornography and sex toys on the women's desks. The connection between pornography and male violence against women is evident in some of the public cases we have been following. In 2014, Bradley Barton, a white truck driver from Ontario, was acquitted of first-degree murder of Cindy Gladue, an Indigenous mother involved in prostitution. Barton was a John and a consumer of pornography. Police found violent pornography on Barton's computer that depicted the torture of women. These findings were never presented at trial because his defense lawyer successfully argued it had no significance in the case. We, as frontline workers, know the significance pornography has on violence against women. It is clear that Barton consumed pornography, then he bought a prostituted woman to act out what he saw, which resulted in her death. Another example is Gian Gomeshi, whose violence, the slapping, the choking, the sexual harassment, all echo the most showcased element of mainstream pornography, violence against women. In fact, in 2015, American researchers watched 305 mainstream pornographic films and found that 88.2% of these films featured violence, including slapping, gagging, and choking. Gian's inclination to choke women was not an organic impulse. He saw it in pornography. He saw it used as a tactic to restrain women, to subdue women's protests, and to exert his dominance over a woman. It was an act of violence that he was repeatedly shown. It was reinforced time after time as a way around a woman's consent. It was eroticized and sexualized for his visual enjoyment. As Gian's victims escaped the reins of his hands, he was able to continue consuming violence against women through pornography until it was his time to attack again. To women, there is no need to speculate about whether the women he attacked consented to this type of sexual violence. Men know choking is an act of violence. It inflicts physical pain and induces fear. In pornography, women's fear is an avenue for male pleasure. It is taunted or completely ignored by the men in pornography as well as in our own lives. In my 5 years' experience working with Vancouver Rape Relief, I have noticed that men are becoming increasingly violent when they rape women. As rape crisis workers, we know when to ask a woman if her attacker is a consumer of violent pornography. It's clear by his violence, it's clear by what he does to her and what he says to her. Women are frequently choked, slapped, verbally degraded by the men who rape them. Beyond that, there is a general expectation by men for women to willfully accept more aggressive sexual encounters. One man attempted to smother a woman with a pillow during sex. When confronted, he told the woman he saw it in porn and thought she would like it. Another woman described to us a consensual encounter with a man who, after becoming increasingly violent during sex, ignored her safe word. Rough sex is normalized in pornography, and more women are expected to endure it or even enjoy it. Radical feminists have been leading the resistance against pornography for many, many years. The analysis that I and many other younger feminists have now can be contributed to those women. Though the fight needs to continue and it needs to be strengthened. Stopping pornography goes beyond just shielding our eyes from it and encouraging others to do so. It's about challenging the men who produce and consume pornography. It's about resisting the notion that pornography is a healthy faucet of our sexualities. It's about coming together as women, speaking frankly about porn's impacts on the violence we have experienced in our lives and doing something about it. In fact, I'm inviting women in this room to join me in a consciousness-raising night about pornography in January 2017. Come to me afterwards if you're interested. We as feminists are faced with the seemingly impossible task of dismantling an industry backed by popular complacency and billion-dollar profits. As feminists, we know the task is daunting, yet we must remain unyielding in our fight against pornography. Our liberation depends on it. Thank you. So we have about 12 minutes for questions.
For either one of you, what's your response to what seems to be the mainstreaming of the notion that women are, the idea of men choking women as something for their pleasure in during sex?
I just think it's insane.
But how is it happening? Why is this becoming a mainstream, socially acceptable?
So the thing about this kind of sex, this kind of porn sexuality, is that you need more and more and more. I actually went and interviewed with my friend Gail Dines. You may know her work. She's a very world-renowned researcher on porn and somebody who writes a lot about porn. And we went and interviewed. We were invited by the woman who was a warden of a men's supermax prison in Connecticut in the United States. We were invited by her to come and interview these sexual offenders because she was so terrified by what she was seeing that over the last decade she had noticed that it used to be when men came in who were sexual offenders, they were ashamed of what they'd done. And they kept their heads down, and they didn't make trouble. They were terrified, And they knew to no shame. And she said, this next generation, there's no shame. And it's the pornography, right? They're saturated in this stuff, and they just have no shame about what they've done, and they think they're completely entitled to it. And I don't know what to do with these guys, but somebody needs to do something because this is a public health crisis. So she invited us to come to this prison, and we interviewed these guys about, how they got into porn, why they were doing this, and we just let them talk about their lives. And it was absolutely horrifying. Because a whole bunch of them were, at this point, they were in there for offenses against children, and they were not pedophiles. Until they saw the porn, it had never occurred to them to lust after children. And it only took 3 months of seeing child porn on the internet for them to then become offenders. 3 months. I thought maybe 2 years. 3 months was all. That's the level of saturation. I mean, when you're sitting there hour after hour viewing these images. But the point is, it's because they got bored. There's only so much you can do an adult woman. And then it gets boring because this kind of sex is, it's like this addictive rush and you need more each time. And they all said that in one way or another, that they needed more, they needed more. What's the next thing? And the pornographers know this. They've studied it. They play to it. So the next ad comes across and it's something a little different, something they haven't tried yet. What else can we do to a woman's body? Right? How much more abuse can she take? And this is, the downhill slope that has happened so fast over the last 20 years. And my point about all of this is, so we're, totally just overwhelmed and traumatized having spent a day with these guys. We're outside, waiting to get our car, and we're just like, breathe, it's all right, because there's still goodness in the world, I promise. And it sort of occurred to me, we hear this narrative over and over, I needed more, and I'm like, there's something so addictive about this. And then I realized, it doesn't even make sense to me. There's nothing in me that has ever said, I need more, it has to be more. What have I ever wanted in terms of sex, of sexuality? It's like, since I was 13, 14, just look at me and say you love me. There's never a more to that. That's all there is, right? That's what human connection is. And I realize what these people are doing does not relate to anything that I know that I would call sex. It's a completely different experience because I don't need more and more and more. I just need that one thing, But this is what they play to, is that there is something in the limbic system, something in the brain that just, you get acclimatized, you need more. And this shows me that this is not really sex. It is something else. Something else that is just so much bigger and so much more overwhelming. And they need more, right? So you break that boundary. That's the problem. And then there's always another boundary to break. And you've got to find that boundary. If you've, constructed your sexuality around this idea that it's about breaking boundaries, there's always going to be another boundary. And this is where this has gone. And they're already done with things like, vaginal sex, double penetration, the anal rape, the oral, all this. It's boring now. They need something else. And what's more sadistic than choking someone? You kill them in a minute. It's over so fast. We need oxygen. Is there a
bigger impulse, a bigger instinct than trying to get air for animals. No, I mean, that's it. You're dead so fast. So of course they've eroticized this. When I was a teenager, nobody choked anybody and called it sex. It didn't exist. I'm telling you, they've created new forms of rape, and that's why. It's because they've got to break boundaries, and there's always another boundary that has to be broken, and that's all they can get off on at this point. I am rambling. I know I'm just ranting, but that's why. It's because the breaking of boundaries is what they've made their sex about, and so you always need another boundary. So they're going to keep finding ways to hurt the human body, and I don't know what they're... Even the pornographers admit it. They say, we don't know where this can go next. We've done everything we can do on camera. Like, what's left? How else can we hurt women? And they don't know. Because they're out. They're out of ideas at this point. But that's where that comes from.
I think, and just a continuation on your point in the air about that breaking boundaries, is that what I've noticed is that a really mainstream type of pornography is now pseudo-incest pornography, where adult women, adult men are playing children or having, like, a daddy-daughter role. And when I was looking up stats about pornography, like when I talked about Pornhub, the category that went up almost the most by like 200%, it was stepmom and son. And this is a really growing, disturbing trend. And I think it speaks to that breaking boundaries because they have nowhere else to go but now this. Yes.
Regarding the comment on RCMP, mm-hmm. That was over 1,000 women didn't make charges. They weren't, some were fired before the courts happened.
Yeah.
And I'm seeking a local or provincial or national focus on the announcement, the recent announcement, like action.
Mm-hmm.
Separately, the Vancouver police, we caught them within a year, 17 of the officers on porn. And the chief of police retired, and his top-notch guys, rather than face up in court. And so we asked the union, what's going on with that? Most of the people at the police board don't even know, have any training on policing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that inquiry coming up. Is there a remedy or a local focus regarding the, first, the RCMP? Like there hasn't, is the limit... The country remains silent after the announcements of the RCMP. So I'm seeking an action to support or create in regard to supporting the women, as well as the the Vancouver police and Vancouver community remained silent. There was a little blurb on the news last year when we busted them and asked them, why are they being paid? And 17 officers on form through Battered Women's Association busted them, and we brought it up at our monthly meeting, but we remain silent, and so it's not that we are consenting by remaining silent. I'm just seeking a remedy of action or something, because we've got this murder trial coming up, and people may recall the Opal Inquiry findings were that the same RCMP in North Van, Fort Coquitlam, and Vancouver Police Department, the three were charged with withholding evidence on rape crimes, murder crimes, missing crimes for those years, 1997 to 2002. And the Opal Inquiry was to say, well, why was he stayed? The findings were that the three police in charge without evidence. Nothing happened. There was no public outcry, not one statement or anything. So I'm seeking a remedy for workshops.
Yeah, let's reconnect afterwards and we can talk more about what we can do. I don't know of anything off the top of my head, but let's get talking.
Sure.
Juliet.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for both of your presentations and extending up where do we best put our energies for action, right? I just want to speak up about the criminal justice system to begin with. We've got patriarchal problem in its most intense venue where, my background is I've experienced a long-term imprisonment, and I witnessed like the most sexually abused women in the country were in prison. Okay, like 97% of the women in prison have been sexually abused, right? And then I also witnessed in the pretrial for Robert Pickton, there were porn tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that were not allowed to be entered into evidence. They successfully argued it out. So, in terms of the feminist, like radical feminist fight, the courts and the criminal justice system is where really where it's needed. It really needs to be focused there because it's just unfair, the levels of unfairness. And even in the Ghomeshi trial, we saw him walk, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and the women were shamed. Mm-hmm. It's just incredibly archaic, and it's not keeping up even minuscule with feminist ideology, right? And so I really think my fight, that's where I like to see my fight working there. If anybody wants to talk about that, I'm Juliet.
Hi, Julie. Good to see you again.
One more question.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more. The back one.
As a millennial myself, and kind of like seeing the effects that pornography has on my generation, and kind of like talking to women my age about sex and, you know, what enjoying, having them say, like, I enjoy being choked, I enjoy and stuff, and I was even having this conversation with someone at work yesterday, and I try and, like, come to the table with this argument of, like, you know, there is a certain kind of conditioning and whatnot. I find myself sometimes at a loss trying to, like, figure out a way to sort of, I guess how would I educate people or women of my generation that these issues are not necessarily choices that we make, but they're imposed on us. Mm-hmm. I find it sometimes challenging because now I think the idea or notion or definition of feminism is just so muddied and skewed. A lot of women are like, well, that's feminism. I get to choose if I want to be choked. So, like, how do I approach, I guess, a group of women who are programmed to believe that this is what they want without, I guess, scaring them away from, you know, what I truly am trying to say, and, like, just allowing for, like, a realization that these choices are not, you know, some, like, liberated choices. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if I really formulated that.
No,
One thing to remember, well, first of all, thank you for having these conversations. Yeah. Because it's, you know, the only drop of sanity they're ever going to hear. I mean, we're all surrounded by this just intense amount of sexual sadism at this point. So thank you for being brave enough to say this. And I don't have specific advice, but just always keep in mind that, you know, it may be the first time they've ever heard it. Their whole lives they've been told, this is what it means to be a sexual being. This is what it means to be a woman. This is how you have to have a man, and this is how you keep him. You have to do these horrible things. And they've seen it everywhere. Like, you're the only person who's ever said, maybe this isn't so good. And none of us change our minds instantly. And actually, psychological research shows it takes 5 years to change your mind. So you're the first one, you know, and hopefully they hear it again somewhere else. And then hopefully they hear something on the radio and it's the third time. And then they see a book and it's the fourth time. And then some article says it's the fifth time. And then they hear about, you know, Gian Ghomeshi and it's the sixth time. And they, you know, they put it together and finally, you know, it sort of collapses. And you're like, you know what? This is actually really horrible. But it takes time to get to that because, I mean, part of coming to political consciousness is understanding that you colluded in your own oppression. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is just, it can be so humiliating to realize, you know, I kind of did this to myself. I embraced this. And we can understand all the pressures on women to do that and how we're socialized into it. But there's still that moment of, okay, I did this to myself too. And it's really hard, you know, because you have to get your self-respect back then. So we're up against a lot as women. And also, I mean, Andrea Dworkin made this point years ago in her book, Right Wing Women, but, you know, a lot of women, I think, see the world accurately, that men have all the power, they've got the money, they control the institutions, and what do we have but, you know, this fledgling hope for justice? And they choose this side realistically, knowing who's going to win. Mm-hmm. And it's all wrapped up in that. And we have to show them that it's a better way to go for justice, even if, you know, you have to abandon a lot, that you're worth fighting for, mm-hmm. you know? So all of that is sort of like in the back of my mind when I have those conversations as well. And I know I'm not going to change someone's mind the first time. You know, you just have to keep going. And you have to drop it sometimes and then try again. But, you know, get that book, The Porn Trap, and leave it around the office. I'm so serious. That book, because it's not particularly radical feminist, it just talks about what porn does to people's brains and how it destroys their ability to be intimate. And who can't relate to that? Like, I want to be close to my intimates. Look how this has destroyed our ability to be close. And so women really love that book. Men, too. I mean, a lot of men have come through the porn world and realized, I mean, that's what the work they do is they're therapists and they deal with addiction. And they realize that men were being overwhelmed by this, and then more and more women as well. But it's a great book for that. It's exactly for that audience because it's not a big, heavy political. You don't got to get the Andrew Dworkin and the scary framework. It's just, this shit is hurting me, you know. And then here's a framework for why this hurts. And you don't have to, you know, continue. You can. So that's, you know, one good sort of mainstream source. But don't ever give up. That's one thing. Because those women do need you. Nobody wants to be choked, okay? I don't believe it. I don't. So,
yeah, it's isolating because, you know, being a millennial and having these beliefs and knowing I have, you know, that I have the consciousness, I have the politics, I know what women are telling me, it's isolating. And just join a group, talk to other women, have those conversations with women that you know are in line with what you believe. Just don't get stuck in the isolation.
Get them to the consciousness raising
group. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just say it's a porn. It's a group about porn.
All right, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for coming to Round the Corner.